outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gene. The God Gene. The God Gene.
Welcome, God Journey friends and family. This is take three of starting an intro to a podcast series that honestly I couldn't fathom that we would be recording at this time. But we are about to explore the last several weeks of Wayne and Sarah's journey and some of the trauma and the different challenges that they've faced. And we're going to unpack a story of God's healing and redemption that I got to have witness of firsthand, and it still leaves me speechless. Without further ado, Wayne and I are going to start off with a conversation between him and I, and we're going to kind of unpack what his experience of the last few weeks have been, and then Sarah has offered very graciously to come into the conversation and share her side, and then Wayne and Sarah are going to be in the conversation together about what God's been up to over the last several weeks. We're just going to allow God to unfold this story and hope that it's a blessing and encouragement to everybody who's listening to it.
And Sarah hasn't offered. Sarah's really insisted on joining us. If you've heard some of the recent podcasts with Sarah, we did two a couple of years ago. She said this was her last podcast because she does not enjoy a microphone. But honestly, Kyle, I never thought I would share this story because it's so much of it involves Sarah in ways that I would never expose her to the world, and it's not the world's business. And yet Sarah has come to me saying, I want to tell this story and I want you to tell your story because I know this will help other people. And so Sarah's stretching her comfort zone, and we don't know how to start this. It probably should start 64 years ago, but it's not. It's going to start on April 11th and tell a little bit of what I went through and then kind of help unpack how that came to be. On April 11th, I was flying home from 11 days in the East Coast in South Carolina, North Carolina. I'd had some time with people that had been incredible, and then spent a weekend with a couple of brothers playing golf and watching the Masters and flying home on, which is always the best day of the trip. It's return to home day. It's Sarah Day. And I'm flying home just thinking about it on the plane. Can't wait to get home. Can't wait to see her. It's been a long time. We just had a week in Colorado before I had left on this trip, where she and I just had this wonderful romantic getaway and time with our son, and was flying back and just really looking forward to it. We landed at the airport, texted her, hey, Sarah, landed, looking forward to seeing you. And I got a text back that said, I'm sorry, I can't pick you up. I've arranged for a car to meet you at baggage claim. And that just was so unlike Sarah. I just thought, wow, something's going on. So I called her.
Yeah.
She didn't answer. I went to voicemail, and then I called again, and it didn't even ring this time, so she had turned her phone off. And then I tried to text her. I tried to call my children, text my children. I got nothing back. I'm just taxiing to the gate, getting out of the plane, going downstairs, meeting this guy who's taking me back. I'm trying to reach people I can't reach. I get in the car, and I've got this hour and 15-minute car ride home. I'm at that point, I'm either expecting Sarah has died and people don't want to tell me over the phone, or Sarah's been in an accident, she's in serious condition somewhere, or the other thing is every person's fear who's flown back from a trip, maybe she's left me. Maybe she's not even going to be there at all. And that car ride home was an absolute nightmare in the uncertainty of where my life was. And it also gave me time to talk to Jesus about it. Just say, okay, God, I don't know what's going on here. But whatever option I can think of, I'm going to need you. I'm going to need you huge. And we got to the driveway, pulled in, opened the garage door, and Sarah's car's gone. And most of the garage has been cleaned out. There's very little there. My golf clubs in my car and a few things, books for Lifestream. And I knew then that she was gone. Didn't know why. You know, if we'd been fighting, if we'd had harsh words between us, she'd been wanting something. I wasn't getting, you know, we just didn't have any of that. We it just completely, completely ambushed on this thing and walked inside the house, and her office is the first thing I see, completely empty. I walk in, stuff in the kitchen's missing, gone. One of our dogs is laying by the back door, wagging her tail, but just looking devastated. And I'm like, she always runs to greet me. She didn't do that. She just laid there and looked at me like, you know, her world had ended. And there was a letter for me laying on the counter. And man, I without saying much about it, the first line of it was, "I can only imagine what you're feeling right now. You must be angry, shocked, hurt, devastated, upset, and feel betrayed." And it was interesting. When I read the line, I went, "Man, I'm shocked. I'm shocked and I'm devastated. I'm not angry. I don't even know if I feel betrayed yet, because I don't know why. I don't know why we're doing this." So it's 13 pages typewritten letter. So it took me a while to go through it. And it was I've been miserable in this relationship for a long time. And she's telling me things that hurt her that are old, 15, 20, 25 years old. I mean, it's stupid things that I said, most of them in humor. Other times when I've just kind of lost my patience with a computer we're working on or something. And, you know, I always let frustration kind of get out of my system quickly and move on. And some of that had hit Sarah in ways that had been hurtful. And the end of it, she said, "I'm brokenhearted, but I cannot live with you anymore. And I don't want more conversations. If you do, you need to take it up with my lawyer." But that was the thing that was the first indication that this was not Sarah. Sarah's not any of this. Sarah's not holding things from 20 years ago. Sarah's not, I didn't feel like she was that woman and I didn't feel like I was that guy, but I had no way to talk to her. I had no way to communicate with her. So I'm all alone in my house on a night I've flown back from the East Coast to be with my wife.
What was that first night like, Wayne? I mean, you and I haven't talked much about the first night after you landed and just where you went after you had this 13-page letter and none of your family is communicating with you. You can't get a hold of your kids. You can't get a hold of Sarah. And yet you're left with this letter that is indicating in some regards, all of a sudden, this isn't your wife. Like, there's another person that you just bumped into and you're not sure who they are.
Yeah, not sure at all who they are. And the hardest thing was just no ability to communicate and get questions answered. I had a million questions.
Yeah.
And there was no way to go. About 45 minutes after I got home, I got a text from my daughter. My son was in town from Denver. They said, "Can we come over?" Mm. And so now I know they know. And there's a lot of embarrassment here. There's a lot of shame from the letter. I think things I thought we had long since dealt with were very forefront of Sarah's mind and heart. And as I reached out to some people the next day, I didn't reach out to anybody that night, but I've told people, and I'll say it here again, I will never say anything bad about Sarah. Sarah has been the most giving, wonderful, courageous person I know on this planet. And it didn't say to me, "Oh my gosh, I Sarah's a bad person or whatever." I just went, "This is not her. And she's describing somebody I don't recognize as me."
Yeah.
I don't. And I have no answer. The kids come over and pretty much, you know, that they've known that this was going to happen. No one thought to warn me that they're going to let me come back. It's kind of like driving your car toward a cliff and no one's going to tell you until the car is over the cliff. "Oh, by the way, that road ends there." It was devastating. It was embarrassing to have my kids know more about what was going on than I did. And I just asked them, "Is she done with me?" And they both said, "Yeah, you'll never see her again." Hmm. And I'm like, "What? This makes no sense to me."
Yeah.
And then they just tried to comfort me. And Sarah had left manuals on the table. There's 3 inches of a notebook about how to take care of Abby, the dog. There's three notebooks on our personal finances and 2 on Livestream. And Sarah's always managed all that for me. And she put everything together so she would never have to talk to me again about anything. And I just looked at all that stuff and went, "There's no way. I'm not that bright. I don't care." I thought the ministry is probably over. That's why, you know, we talked, said, hey, let's put everything on hiatus. If all this is true, this is what I felt like. I felt like I've lived a lie for the last 47 years of my life. That's what it felt like. My whole marriage has been a lie. My life has been a scam. And I went to bed that night, but I didn't sleep. I didn't sleep a wink. I laid awake. I cried. I talked to God about Sarah. I talked to Sarah. I just talked in the ether to Sarah and told her I wasn't angry at her, that I loved her, that I had no idea what had happened, but that I loved her, would always love her. It brought me back to 10 years before. If people don't remember that podcast, you can go back. We'll put the links to it here. But I was in Russia when Sarah kind of bumped up against this wall 10 years ago, and it really changed our marriage in dramatic ways after I got back. I thought for the better.
Yeah.
And that encounter in Russia in the middle of the night, same kind of night, tears and crying, and feel like my, you know, Sarah had written some very hard things to me that I didn't think were true either, very similar to this letter. And I felt like God asked me in the middle of the night, if Sarah could only know my joy without you, would you let her go? And after 3 hours of wrestling, I tell that story in the other podcast, I said, yeah, I would, if that's, and it's a teller. And so I did. And my telling her opened an incredible door of love and realizing for her that she didn't want to leave me. She wanted me. She'd never be happy without me. And so we got back into, and it was, we got back into a, I thought over the last 10 years, the best relationship. And I always had my eye on her. What serves her? Mm-hmm. What works for her? And I thought about that as I'm laying there just in tears and agony. And I felt like God said to me, you told me I could do this. Mm. And I'm going, gosh, I didn't mean it. That's the first thing out of my mouth. I didn't mean it. I mean, I'm having this interaction with God. God's right there. But, you know, you told me I could do this. I need her to myself right now. And I'm like, I don't want her. Because whatever state she's in, it's not good. It's not good. And I don't want her alone. And I don't know that I trust her with you. Mm. I mean, I know I say that. That's part of me. The other part of me, as soon as I say stuff like that, knows, gosh, she's better with you than me. No, that's just better. So I cried all night. It just hurts. And, it wasn't that night, but the next day, just follow through on that. One of the things I've said about my whole life, you know, what is your greatest achievement? And I've always said my life with Sarah. The line from the notebook, I've done one thing in my life, that I've loved the woman well. And I've used that so many times when I talk about Sarah. If I get to the end of Sarah's life and she says to me, or my life, you've loved me well, that's all I would ever want. Everything else is gravy on the mashed potatoes, right?
Yeah.
And I remember saying to God a few days later, I failed. I failed at the only thing I ever wanted. And the next thought in my mind was, not yet. Not yet, you haven't. And those are the things you're afraid to believe, right? I'm afraid to, because that like serves me. Yeah, I know, not yet. No, in every way, it looks like I have failed. My wife has left me in the dead of night when I thought everything was wonderful in our marriage. I thought everything was just wonderful. I thought she was happy. I had no idea. And she'll say this when she comes and talks too. Part of what was in the letter was that she had been suicidal and she would either leave me or take her life. That was the question. And my first, I sent her a text and just said, look, or an email. I just said, if this decision was about leaving me or committing suicide, good decision. You made the right one. The only way this is worse is if you're not here.
Yeah.
And whatever you need from me, even if that's a distance, I'll give it to you. But I said, I don't think this letter's all true. I hope we can talk about it someday.
Yeah.
The next morning, I got up and had not slept at all. I got up at 5:30, just got tired of it and did some working out and then went to shave and shower. And as I opened the window next to where my sink is, this dove came and landed on the railing. And doves travel in twos. I don't know if everybody knows, but they mate for life and they pair for life. And this dove landed by itself on the railing, and it was obviously the male. And I looked at him and I just said, dude, I know how you feel. That's what came out. And immediately his partner came and landed next to him. And I was taken back because I thought he was alone. And they kind of cooed and cuddled for a minute, and then off they flew together. And at that moment, I just felt like the Holy Spirit said, I'll bring her back to you. I'll bring her back. Don't worry. And interestingly enough, I saw those doves every day until Sarah did. Every day.
Wow, I didn't know that it was every day.
Every day. And it was at different times in different places. And it was, even when Sarah and I weren't back yet, we had a conversation. She was sitting on my patio and we were talking alone. You'd been here. We'll get more to that down the road. But she was talking to me and I was saying, is there any chance you want to explore? Is this over? And she said, I hope to, but I can't promise that. And just then, in the crook of her shoulder, between there's a branch and a pepper tree 20 feet behind where she's sitting. But right between her left ear and her left shoulder, in that crook of her shoulder, was a branch. And those two doves at that moment came and landed on that branch. And again, the thought in my head is, don't take your encouragement from Sarah. Not right now. Just let it happen. So those little doves were the only, I mean, the only positive sign that, I mean, I had immediately that next morning, I started to call. I called you. I called five or six other brothers. I wasn't going to let a lot of people into this because I didn't want to expose Sarah. I didn't care about exposing me. If my life had been a lie for 64 years, I don't know why God invited Sarah and I a number of years ago to live our lives in the light. And that's how Sarah and I talk about it.
Yeah,
that we have most helped people on our journey, not by the wisdom Wayne has or share or the teaching skills or, you know, vocabulary or writing. It's not my communicative skills. It's been my honesty. It's been my openness. It's been walking people through my pain as well as my joy. So I didn't mind for me if people knew all about this because it'd be something to learn.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to expose Sarah to it. And as I would talk to these, I just felt like God put five or six on my heart. I called them. I told them exactly what was happening, told them what the letter said. I told them what I was going through. And I just said, I need you to pray. I just need you to pray. And they did. And I got encouragement from all of them. All of them were saying, this is not Sarah. This can't be the way it is. Something else is going on here. And so we just prayed, encouraged each other, and I also called a sister that Sarah knows really well, someone that was with us on a trip, and she had a dream that was just profound at this point of encouraging me to understand the process that was going on in Sarah's heart, even though I couldn't see it from where I was.
Wayne, I remember that phone call, and that was, I remember exactly where I was at. It was weird for you to call me in the morning, that normally you don't call me in the morning, especially when you know that I'm working. And thankfully, I was just starting my 2-hour drive to one of my farthest school districts. And I called you back and you told me, you're like, Sarah's left me. And you kind of have like a sarcastic, sometimes like edgy sense of humor.
I manage pain with a warped sense of humor. That's true.
The first thought that came through my mind is like, dude, this is too far. Like, if you're joking, this is way too far. Like, that literally was the thought that went through my head. I was like, no, there's no way. Like, there's no way. But I listened to the tone of your voice and just the exhaustion and the sorrow that I heard there. And I was like, oh, this is for real. Yeah. I mean, This is actually happening right now, and I don't know why, but this is happening. And man, I remember hanging up on the phone with you and just so thankful that I had the drive that I did, because it was just like, I'm amazed that I got there safe. I'm pretty sure that the angels took me on cruise control and grabbed a hold of the steering wheel and got me to my school district in decent shape, because I was in tears for you both. I was just crying out to the Lord and saying, Father, what is going on? Because I knew that Sarah wasn't doing well. I knew that there were some things that she had been struggling with, but I had not seen any of any indicators that this level of conflict between the two of you would lead to something like this. And so it was just shocking to me. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
As those next days unfolded, what was that process like for you? I heard a lot of different stages. I heard you talk about the despair of, I think my life is over. I don't know if I can experience joy without having Sarah as a part of it. Has my life been a lie? You know, there was a lot of different things that I heard you navigating. And then you talked about the dream. You talked that your sister, your friend shared with you. You talked about the doves and wanting to hope, like barely being able to kindle any kind of sense of hope that might have been God. And I remember you just saying, God showed me this. I don't know if I can trust it. Like, I want to, but I don't know if I can trust this. I don't even know if I can hope, if I can even hold hope.
And afraid I was playing the fool, that the yes. hope would keep me compliant in a way that would let someone else take advantage of the situation. So,
yeah.
And I felt like that with my kids. I felt like that with everything. I could be just playing the fool here. Poor deranged guy. Can't take a hint. I got a 13-page note that's well beyond a hint. It gets lost, creepo. I want nothing more to do with you. Although Sarah sang in a very gracious way and saying, I know this isn't me. I know this doesn't sound like me. I am heartbroken and devastated. I never wanted this to happen. And yeah, but those next 3 weeks, it was 3 weeks before I had much communication with Sarah. Early on, there was just where she was living, which she didn't let me know where she was, but she couldn't always keep a dog there. And so she wanted to bring the dog up here and have me watch it during the day if she had appointments or whatever. So Julie was going to transfer dogs back and forth. And I texted Sarah and I said, man, our daughter's going to hate us if she's going to do all this driving around because her parents aren't. Why don't you just bring her here and I'll make you this promise. You bring the dog. If you're picking up a dog, I'll put it in the garage. You can come open the garage, take her, and leave. If you drop one off, put it in the garage. I promise I will not come out and talk to you until you invite me. And I don't know why I say stupid things like that, because we have a camera that points in our front yard. So
yeah.
I know when Sarah's coming because Sarah doesn't want to run into me. So, you know, is the dog in the garage and I'm 2 minutes away or whatever? And I'd go, yeah, I'm fine. And I would just stare at her. I'd watch her on the camera. And she would pull up and she would go open the door, get the dog out, put a dog in, whatever, get back in. And this was happening once or twice every day I'm seeing her. And I'm just crying. I'm crying the whole time. I'm telling God, this is killing me. There's times when she's less than 10 feet from me through a door.
Yeah.
And all I have to do is open it. And she's there. And I promised her I wouldn't. And I didn't. A couple weeks into that, one day I just asked her, I said, could I come out and say hi? And she says, no. That was the only answer I had, was no. And she'll tell her own side of what she was going through in those moments, but it was devastating. At the same time, I feel like God's doing things in my heart. One, it's really caused me to really look back through the whole of my marriage and everything ever done, some of it too introspective, too painful to think about. I vacillated between holding on to an encouragement that this was not one of the things that God said when the doves were there, this is not what it appears to be. Yeah. And I tried to believe that, but yeah. I tell you, then I'd be overwhelmed with agony and grief. And, you know, what would life be like if Sarah's not in it again? What does vacation looks like? I never had a future. I mean, Sarah and I got married in the old days of the marriage vow means something. And yeah. I know it means something to her. I know that. I know this was not a light decision.
Yeah.
But I never had a plan to live on without Sarah. I even thought, you know, if something happens to Sarah, if somebody breaks into an apartment and kills her, right? I am suspect number one, and I've got no alibi living here. I've got no one here to say, yeah, he was home. I'm just like, oh my gosh. I felt incredibly vulnerable in lots of ways. And the pain that's in my heart. And I would often go to the garden. And if people have seen Sarah's garden, if not, maybe that's the picture we'll use for this podcast. But yeah. Sarah's got this beautiful garden, an English garden that she's made. And I would go out there in my tears because that's where I felt closest to her. I just felt closer to her there. And I would pray there for her and I would cry. And I would, at night, every night, going to bed alone was the worst. I just I'm on this intermittent fasting regimen still. So every morning it was, can I get to lunch and get a meal? That's the only thing that made me happy. And then it was the afternoon. Can I get to dinner? And then that. And then after dinner, it's all ugly. It's sitting here home alone. It's going to bed alone. It's trying to sleep, which I couldn't do. It was just praying for her. And at one point, I started just talking to her. I pray to God for a long time, everything I could say about it. I said, God, I'm going to talk to Sarah now. And whatever way you can work your magic and put this into her spirit, you do it. Because I know I can't talk to her. And I would tell her how much I loved her and that you have not done too much. If there's anything in you that regrets anything, there's a way back. And I would just tell her that. And I would tell her how loved she was, how safe she was. I didn't know what was going on with her. But one day when I was in the garden and I'd been praying for her there, I was just leaving it that morning. In fact, you called me and you said, I've got a thought for you. And I said, what's that? And he said, I think God gave me three words, tend her garden. And I asked you, I remember saying, is that metaphorically or is that literally? People know I grew up on a farm, man. I've worked in the dirt all I want to. Sarah gets to have her garden because she loves to work in the dirt. I don't. And you said, I think literally. And I went, crap. With apologies to our UK friends. Shoot. And I said, okay, I think that's good. And the reason why, I'd been receiving a lot of from the people praying for me. And then people who didn't know what I was going through at all. But people, I'd get quotes about tenderness. It was like God was screaming through every orifice in the universe. Tender, tender, tender. And a good friend of mine who's also a therapist, not my therapist, but a therapist. When he heard about it, he said, no, this isn't Sarah. He said, what comes to mind for me is the Horse Whisperer. Seen the movie? Mm. I said, yeah, years ago. He said, watch it again. Watch the accident. Mm. And then watch the Robert Redford character in the meadow. And so I did, I watched it that night and man, it was so horrific. The accident is so horrific. Yeah. And then the horse is so wounded and angry and fearful and running out in the thing. And the Robert Redford just comes and just waits, just stays in the horse's sight line, just waits, lets the horse come to him. Doesn't run out there to rope it, doesn't break a horse. And interestingly enough, I'd met somebody on my recent trip that we haven't really talked a lot about that, but she's a horse trainer. And she was talking about the whole way they've shifted horse training from breaking a horse's spirit to connecting with its heart. And so I look at all the way God has seeded things into this moment and watch it. And then the horrible thing about the movie at the end, this gal who owns the horse in the movie is married to a guy but falls in love with the Robert Redford character. And then the husband comes and sees that they've connected. And then he says, don't come home until you're happy. And I just cried my eyes out. I just thought, I don't know if Sarah will ever be happy again, and she won't be happy here. And I lost it and called my friend, said, you should tell me not to watch the last scene of the movie. Go, oh, yeah, I just wanted you to watch those two parts. I'm going, yeah, it's not fair. But this same guy told me, he said, Wayne, I want you to understand something. There is a kind of therapist out there, which he calls them, they're feminists, and the male is always the problem. And to save your wife, she may have made a monster out of you. And he called her Frankenstein. So she could put all of her pain on you and blame you. And then she can run from you. You're something she can run from. And it seemed far-fetched, to be honest. It seemed a little bit unbelievable. But it certainly would help describe what was going on. Yeah. So I learned to be tender. I went back in the garden the day you called me and I was out there pulling weeds in her irises that were blooming at the time. And I'm a fast guy. I don't know why I'm even on that day fast, because I'd shut down everything. I wasn't blogging. We weren't podcasting. I didn't have work to get to other than survival work. I had shopping and laundry, all the things that I've never done. I know it's horrible. 47 years of marriage. That might have been enough to make Sarah leave. But Sarah's just caretaked for me so well. I've never done any of those things. So I'm trying to figure out just survival stuff. But I'm in a hurry. And so I'm pulling weeds in these irises and I'm just going to work for a while. I'm trying to get as much done as I can. And I reach for a weed that I think I can get to, but I couldn't. And it was out of reach. And to reach for it, I had to move my foot to catch my balance. And I broke an iris limb off, broke the leaves, broke it off. And because I'd been in the garden and because now I had seen it as a place to pray for Sarah, this like the garden in the shack, Max Hart, I was seeing Sarah's heart in her garden. And so I just was praying as I was pulling weeds. I was asking God to pull things out of her heart or put things in her heart or whatever. And when I broke that flower, my heart hurt like I had wounded Sarah. I knew logically I'd just broken a flower. There was no big deal.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in my heart, I felt like I'd stepped on something precious. And God just said, you move too fast. The thought ran through, you move too fast for Sarah. Mm-hmm. And what's became a mantra around here after I was in Virginia a couple of weeks ago, John Coleman told me this quote, life moves at the speed of relationship.
Yeah.
I go, you know what? Life needs to move at the speed of Sarah. And it doesn't, not in any way, not in how I drive, not in how I rush around the house to get things done, even make lunch or dinner. I'm just super fast. We bump into each other and go, hey, what are you doing? I was here first. And to me, I'm making jokes about it.
Yeah.
But I'm also moving way too fast. And I came out of the garden that day going, I need to live at the speed of Sarah if she ever comes back. And I need to practice now. It's going to take me a while to drive at the speed of Sarah, to walk at the speed of Sarah, to everything. And so that day began. So I had a little assignment. When I'm in the garden every day, I'm tending to her garden every day while I'm praying for her. So I'm pulling weeds, deadheading flowers. I'm doing all that and praying for her there. And then the other part of it is I'm learning to move slowly in my life. And that has been torturous at times, genuinely. Yeah. I'm a fast thinker. I'm a fast at everything. Even if it's wrong, I'm fast. I at least get there quickly and find out I'm wrong. But slowing down has been torturous, and yet it became increasingly a blessing. I mean, I even make my lunch in the kitchen at one-third the speed I used to, even when Sarah's not there. I'm practicing because doggone it, it's not going to be easy when she gets here.
So what have you felt shifting as you have adjusted to the speed of Sarah? And even I remember you made a comment, we were talking one day and you said, I feel like God moves at the speed of Sarah, not at my speed. What have you seen shifting as you have intentionally oriented your speed and your pace to Sarah's pace and possibly to more towards God's pace? What have you seen unfold? What has unpacked for you?
Awareness.
How so?
Yeah, so much you miss of what's going on around you, other people's feelings or thoughts, because you're just moving on to the next thing. You're just even driving. You're more aware of what's going on. I mean, Sarah, which used to drive me nuts, a car in front of us, quarter mile hits its brakes. Sarah hits hers. I'm like, what are we doing? My gosh, I coast down there. I might take my foot off the brake. This might be one of those traffic backup things. So I'm going to take my foot off, let the car slow down while I approach and see what's going on. Sarah hits the brake she just drives with a sense of awareness. Like I'll be navigating for her and I'll say, hey, turn in here. And she can't do it because she needs time to look behind her. Even though I've done all that and know it's perfectly safe turn, she's going to do it. And by the time she does it, we're past it. I'm like, why do you trust me? You know, which is crazy talk. Now I look back on that's crazy talk. It's awareness of people, their feelings. It's awareness of other drivers around you. It's, letting people in instead of driving so close to the person in front of you that somebody can't get in your lane. I mean, I've done all that, so you're kinder when you move at a slower pace. Now, the real test is going to be next time I'm in an airport because, man, I can move between gates. People are in the way and you're just trying to like run through, just get through all the crowd. So I don't know. That'll be the big test. But now I really intentionally, I mean, I know we give away the ending here. Sarah's back now, and I really live at the speed of Sarah now. And one, I don't trip on the stairs as much, which is really good because at my age, tripping on the stairs can be a bit of a problem.
It could be, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's safer, it's kinder, it's more aware, and you know what? I don't find that I'm getting any less done. So, so I leave 2 minutes earlier or 5 minutes earlier to get where I'm going because I'm going to drive like Sarah.
Yeah.
What? Usually I get there and wait or, I'm just waiting here before I go.
Yeah.
So I don't feel like I'm losing anything. I feel like I'm gaining a lot of awareness, a lot of kindness. And Sarah notices it. Sarah loves it.
How so? What when did Sarah first notice that you were adjusting your pace, and how did she respond?
No, that's a better question for her. I don't really know when she noticed.
I'll ask her.
I noticed she was saying stuff to me like, you know, I love the way you drive now. Mm. And now she's not looking at her phone. She's talking to me while we're driving and looking at traffic together because she's not panicked by what I'm doing in a car. Me, yeah. I never considered what I was doing risky. I'm just a very aggressive driver. I'm going to get there as quickly as I can. And now it just seems silly. My gosh, I'm 69 years old. I should know better than that. But one of the things that was said to me, I want to say here, because this really helped me. One brother who lives here nearby, probably my closest friend right now, is my friend Lewis from the podcast. And he took this very hard. He's close to both Sarah and I, and they're in our home every week. And Sarah had written him a letter saying, I know you're going to hate me. You know, I didn't want to do this to Wayne. This isn't me. And he came crying himself, just going, I don't hate Sarah. And I said, I don't either. We don't have to hate Sarah. And he called her, talked to her, said, I'm not going to hate you. And she was afraid other people would choose between us. And fortunately, none of my friends, I mean, she wrote my board, live stream board, to say she was resigning from the board. And I was like, 2 days, I hadn't even started talking about this stuff yet. I didn't know how to process any of it. Now my board knows. And she said in the letter, I know this isn't me. And I'm going, I know it isn't you. I know. Slow down a little bit, lady. Now you're moving fast. but I didn't have the chance to talk to her. But yeah. He came, but I didn't tell people. I told my kids the same thing. If you feel like at some point you have to choose between Sarah and me, choose Sarah, because I'm okay. I know I'm going to be okay. I don't know that my baby's okay. I think she's not in her right mind, and she will say that when she talks. She wasn't. She had a real psychological break, and nobody around her trusted that I would love her enough to do what was right by her. And that's something I still deal with. Nobody trusted me with her. And, but I could hardly talk about her with Lewis, where I just wouldn't break down crying, and he would break down crying. And he told me one night he had a dream, and he talked to Jesus about me, and he says, can't you take his pain away? And Jesus in the dream said to him, I can't take his pain away without taking his love away.
Hmm.
And I thought, man, that's just a powerful statement. I think of St. Louis, if you love well, you'll hurt much. That's the backside of that. Can I take his pain away? I can, but then I got to take his love away. And so that was profound. And then it was about this time that you and I got into conversation about your missile silo.
Yeah.
We were talking about a lot of what was going on with Sarah in the podcast we were doing about you and your trauma, because that's what's going to unfold here for Sarah. Sarah had some trauma that she didn't even know about. But you talked about how protected that silo was and how you were threatened by anybody trying to get in your silo. And for the previous 6-8 months, I knew something was going on with Sarah. She felt more distant at times. And I would sit down and say, are we good? Are we okay? And what's going on? And she would deny it. And then she would do what I have only learned recently is a trauma response. And that I know about flight, freeze, and flee. I knew those three. I didn't know the fawning one. That there's a way people in trauma fawn so that people, they're trying. One of the main things about trauma is you're trying to hide it from yourself.
Yeah.
And then you're really trying to hide from people who love you and people who get close to you. And in the last 6 months, I was getting very close to Sarah. I mean, there were a lot of late nights. Babe, I don't trust what you're saying to me. I'm afraid you're not telling me the truth. Because then the next week or so, she would go overboard in showing me how much she concerned and how fun she was and lovable, but it was all acting. And it didn't feel, and I would even say, this feels like overcompensating. And she would deny that. So it was really, it was such a struggle. But I think, well, that helped me understand, you know, I maybe was getting really close to what was going on. And then you recommended a therapist to me that was a friend of yours going through training, and turned out she's a trauma specialist. And I made some contact with her, and she's a top-notch therapist. She's busier than any creature on the planet and really good at what she does.
Yes.
She made room for me only because of my friendship with you. And she said, you know what, let's talk on the phone and let me see. Or we Zoomed or something. Anyway, I think we Zoomed. And she said, let me just talk to you. And I said, great. So I talked. She says, what's going on? I just told her the story about Sarah leaving me and my total and complete surprise. It's not like we've been fighting and, or things had been rough. We just had this great week, which asked Sarah, you know, what about that week in Colorado? I come back from Colorado 2 days later, leave to go over go East Coast.
Yeah.
And I said, that was the greatest, romantic, kind, tender, wonderful. And she said, I knew it was our last trip together and I wanted to have special memories for you. It's like, how do you do that? And there's other things. I mean, as I navigated my home here for the next few days, like I knew I had one, Sarah makes this spaghetti that I really like. And I knew I had one bowl of it left because she makes enough when she makes it to get four meals out of it. And I'd had three of them before my trip. So I knew there's one in there. I kept waiting because I didn't want to have the last one. This is the last one ever. Yeah. And so I went to get it one night. Finally, I'm just going to eat it. And there were five more bowls of spaghetti in there. And I went, what? She made, and then I noticed there were cookies or chocolate chip cookies. She'd made four dozen of them and she'd bought treats and candy and things. And I'm going, who does this? Who is going to stab you? And it was Sarah being kind to me. And so that stuff was either the cruelest thing she could do to somebody. Cause if you have to leave somebody, doing it this way is the, and Sarah will say it, is the cruelest way to do it. But it wasn't about cruelty for Sarah. It was about survival for Sarah. And that's what will become clear as she gets into her story. But in these moments I had with Therese on the phone, she asked me, said, do you understand the traumatic brain? And that's all in caps. That's like a thing. And I'm going, I heard about it. This 20s and 30s retreat we were on. There were a lot of people talking about trauma and the book, The Body Keeps the Score. And I thought when I came back, you were talking about EMDR with one of the other guys in the car. And I just thought, man, there's a whole world here I'm completely unaware of. And I thought, I had the thought I should read that book. And I did it. I should have read that book. I don't should on myself, but I should have read that book. Oh my gosh. That is Sarah's story. It is. Sarah and I are reading it together. And we're learning so much about her and about what she was dealing with inside that she will have more time to talk to you about. But Therese went through the traumatic brain, boom, 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 and described, I understood my wife better from that 20 minutes than any decade that we have lived together.
Yeah.
It just, this goes back to Russia and what happened there. This is something. And she said, and she said three things that were very, again, self-serving, but helpful. Wayne, you could have been the perfect husband, and I know you're not, but you could have been, and this would have happened to you. And I'm like, well, what? That didn't even make sense to me.
Yeah.
And she said, and you got to realize, number two, this isn't personal. Okay, hold it. It sort of feels personal. I got home. There's a letter. There's a traumatized dog. There's an empty house. There's no warning hint that was coming my way. This does feel personal. It's just not personal. See, the other thing you got to stop looking for is for a logical reason why Sarah did this.
Yes.
Not in her letter, not anywhere. There's no logical reason. So now I'm even more lost than ever. But now I have some way to hold this. I'm sorry. I'm going to have to break in here. I know you're going to love my voice over the next few weeks as I break in at the end of a podcast to say, that's all we're going to share this week. More of the story will roll out next. It's going to take us probably 6 or 7 podcasts to get through this. So I think the lessons are worth it, though. I think the things it flushes out about our own God journeys for all of us is incredibly important. If you are experiencing trauma or know someone who is, in the podcast notes under this podcast, you're going to find resources that have been incredibly helpful to Sarah and me. Please take advantage of them if you think they'll be helpful to you. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week at The God Journey.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.